Hey Natalie, thanks so much for being here.
Hey Deepak, it's glad to be here. I'm glad to be here.
So let's go with a set of impromptu questions for you. What would you do if you were the governor for 5 days? What would your priorities be?
5 days is not a lot of time to get much done. I think if I were the governor for 5 days, I would take advantage of the surplus that we have had for the last few years. I would direct some funding to early childcare programs in Georgia. I would address some concerns and attentions around healthcare access and affordability in Georgia. Off the top of my head, those are probably the things I would try to tackle in 5 days.
Why do you think it's important for the younger generations to be involved in government relations?
Well, at some point, the elders, if you will, aren't going to be here. And so we tend to, and I think, this is the case for most. When we're young, we tend to take for granted things beyond ourselves, and not thinking about how policy might affect our day-to-day life, or even more importantly, our future. So it's very important for the younger generations to be involved, even if it's only from the standpoint of becoming aware and going and casting their vote. I think, I became a county commissioner when I was 32. I think that the younger generations provide valuable insight, and they absolutely represent, and especially now, right? Looking at the current millennial Gen Z, it's a strong number and growing demographic. Perspectives and things that, some of the older generation or current leaders may not be thinking about on a day-to-day basis. So it's important, to learn how to get engaged. Learn how to become an effective voice. And then, again, primarily and most importantly, is not to take for granted that right to vote and going into engaging in the process and casting your vote during those election cycles.
And how would you, do you think that kind of education where their involvement has to be more, is that missing or lacking in the current education system?
In my opinion, and again, I'm not necessarily in, I'm not in the classroom anymore. But in my opinion and my perception is that we in the classroom maybe are not creating as much awareness and educating around the process as much as we could be or should be. Certainly we teach our children about the branches of government and the balance of powers. How much do we talk about local elected officials and offices, and how that truly impacts, a day-to-day life? How much are we talking to students about what it means to be a county commissioner, or serve on a local level? And how much are we talking about the power of the vote? We talk about movements within, voting, granting rights, further to different demographics throughout the years and the generations of this country. But how much are we talking about what that means today and how to truly engage, how to become aware of candidates that have put themselves out to lead and serve in elected offices. And maybe, the last few years that's increased some is, there's it's a 24-hour news cycle and politics seem to dominate it these days. So I think sometimes, the students can't help but be interested, and are trying to educate themselves. So that'll yield some organic conversation. But I tend to think we can always strive to improve. So a short way to answer that, Deepak, is yes, we could do more.
Okay. And if I had to ask you a very naive question, what does a county commissioner do?
So, it's sort of the executive branch of the county level, right? Where we are making policy for local, or I should say the legislative branch for the local level. We are, making local policy ordinance and decisions that affect how land can be used, where businesses can locate, where we're raising or lowering taxes, right? Property taxes specifically. But then, on a local level, there are things in most states now called local option sales tax, where those go on a ballot referendum to the voter, where they decide to accept or reject an additional local option sales tax. And this would be to raise revenue for things like many counties in Georgia use this for roads maintenance, for public safety efforts like new facilities or equipment. Sometimes it's used for beautification or recreation efforts. If a community decides they want to support maybe more parks or trails. And so, on a very local level, and maybe in many ways, or not maybe, but definitely in many ways, making policy that impacts individuals more directly on a day-to-day basis. Raising one's millage by even 1 point, it can make a real difference that's felt immediately in a property owner, for a property owner.
That's
Attending
interesting.
to public safety, ensuring that that the community has enough personnel, both from a thinking about policing, thinking about firefighters, EMS. These are areas that county commissioners are responsible for, ensuring that there's adequate funding. Again, parks and recreation, roads and bridges. When the Office of County Commissioners was created in Georgia, their two primary responsibilities were looking out for roads and ensuring adequate revenue. In fact, they were called the Commission of Roads and Revenue. So these are the types of responsibilities that fall to county commissions.
Interesting. So if I may just ask a question, one question deeper than this. So this is at the county level, right? So under you or the county commissioner is what the mayors are. The mayors are more responsible at the town level in the city. Is that how it works, or
So,
is it completely two different branches?
so that's a municipal elected leader, and so municipalities are creations of the legislature, and we have seen, especially in the last 10 years or so, a number of new cities in Georgia. But they have councils and mayors that are elected just like county commissioners, but is a different level. So you have cities within counties, and a city council and its mayor would decide on local ordinance or policy, and funding specific to that city. And so it's ordinances, and property zoning and policies and so forth would be specific to the bounds of of the city. And beyond that, in an unincorporated area, that falls to the county. It is there are very similar responsibilities, but it's somewhat different as well. Counties have often what we call they will have a chairman of the board. And sometimes the chairman is elected, sometimes it's appointed from amongst the board. And, then oftentimes you'll see that counties will have a county manager, but that's a staff position versus an elected position.
Got it. Okay. So if I have to switch gears on you here, how would you describe lobbying in one sentence?
That would be difficult for me to describe in one sentence because there are, different different varieties of lobbying, I guess you would say. But ultimately, in one sentence, it's the lobbying is the endeavor to impact policy.
Okay, good answer. What is the hardest part about your job?
Well, it's all about relationships. In Georgia First, we're, our brand of lobbying is advocacy. But it's really is all about relationships and the ability to sit down with folks of varied backgrounds and varied opinions and varied beliefs and be able to have as a productive conversation. If you want to move policy or policy agendas forward, you have to be able to talk to people. One, to effectively share your message, and two, to effectively negotiate policy. There are, again, varied positions and beliefs and values, and in order to move some of these conversations forward, that requires compromise in many cases. So it's all about relationships. So it's very important to be able to build those relationships, maintain those relationships. And in a state like Georgia and our legislature, I mean, that's a lot of ground to cover.
Do you have a favorite issue you've worked on?
I'm the world's worst person to ask about favorites. But I would say, we had the opportunity when I first founded Georgia First to work on the Georgia Mental Health Parity Act, and which was very important for the state of Georgia. And it was a big, I believe, a big policy win. So, to be able to be part of a very historic moment, that's been a favorite for me so far.
Nice. If you had to describe yourself in one word, how would you describe
Tenacious.
it? Nice. Good word. Let's go a little bit into your personality. What is the most daring thing you have done in your life?
Wow, great question. The most daring thing I've done in my life, having kids.
Nice.
But professionally, starting my own business, and being able to be comfortable with that risk, and be able to follow through on that endeavor.
Good answer. Yeah, I can relate to that. What is your pet peeve? Like, what gets on your nerve?
Injustice.
Okay.
I call it part of my personality. And I don't know, Deepak, if you've studied these types of things, Myers-Briggs or Enneagram, but I'm a Myers-Briggs ENTJ and an Enneagram 8. And so we are largely driven by justness. And so it that would be the top of the list, but of course I know that's very ideologic as well. Other pet peeves are When people do what I'm doing now and take too long to get to the point.
Good answer. What is one of your quirky habits? Like what do you do which other people, may, feel that it's driving them crazy about you? Do you have any otherwise?
Oh, I'm sure that I do. But what are they? I'm an avid coffee drinker. Not that I have to have coffee to get going, but I just really love coffee. It is not unlike it is not what's the word I'm looking for? Uncommon to find about four different coffee cups that may be in varied stages of use around my house and office on any given day.
What is your favorite book?
Wow. Again, I'm the world's worst to ask about favorites, but probably that I have read in recent years, Cutting for Stone.
Cutting for someone by who?
Abraham Verghese, I believe I'm saying that last name correctly. And Cutting for Stone was his first novel, if I recall. And he Abraham Verghese is a physician by trade. So brief little bit of trivia about me. I knew that I wanted to be a physician from the time I was probably about 5 or 6 years old. And in fact, I did 3 years of pre-med during my undergrad. But I also started my family fairly young. And in my third year, when we found out we were going to have my second child, I decided that path and pursuit did not line up very well with what my family and children needed from me. And so I decided to walk away from medical and pursuing a medical degree, and finished my undergrad as an English major with a Spanish minor. And so I've always been an avid reader, and that started a new conversation about literature, and much broader exposure to some new authors and genres. So all of that to say, when I read Verghese's novel, Cutting for Stone, the prose is just amazing. He's a fabulous writer. He's a fabulous storyteller. But the empathy and the compassion, his ability to capture human emotion and dynamic is, I laughed, I cried. It was just a phenomenal book.
Oh, nice. I'll have to look that up. What is your favorite? I know I'm asking you a ton of favorite questions, so bear with me here. What is your favorite music?
Well, I am a musician by hobby. Grew up in a very musical family. Probably my go-tos are almost anything in the roots genre. I love blues. I love gospel. I love jazz. I love folk music. My go-tos always tend to be somewhere in the roots genre, even bluegrass. But now you're understanding why it's really I'm the world's worst to ask about favorites.
No, that's okay. I think, yeah, it's pretty hard to pin down on one type of music. So you're good.
I could probably find something I like in almost any genre. But again, as to what I turn on most of the time, it's roots or have some element, right, of that in the vein. So
Nice. If you could have dinner with any three people, dead or alive, who would those be?
dead or alive? These questions probably are always affected by what we're attuned to at any given moment. But two of them are two people who had great impact on who I am as a person and that I just miss dearly. And that would be my grandparents, my mom's mom and dad. And who would I have as the third? Probably my grandson, so that they could meet him.
Wow, that's really cool. So let's jump a little bit into your past. You've given some highlights about your past. At what point did your interest in politics begin?
I kind of feel like, it's just always sort of been there. I can remember, again, speaking of my grandparents, I can remember watching presidential debates, and coverage with them as a kid, and of course I came up in, mostly under the Reagan administration. I was born in 1980. And so, listening to my grandparents talk about politics, watching them watch the coverage, watching it with them, it became an understanding that it was important to be engaged in the conversation, became a part of the running narrative in my mind from a very young age. I can remember at different times my grandfather talking to me about the importance of using my right to vote, making sure that when I got, old enough that I registered to vote. And of course he shared his, political leanings of the time and, which party was, better for the country. And so it's kind of my interest in following and being engaged in the conversation as a citizen has always been there. What was shaped in me is that it's not just a right, but it's our duty to go and vote. And so that was kind of the early positioning for me. I don't know that even up through my early 20s, I ever envisioned that I would run for, much less hold political office. But I also grew up in a very service-oriented family. Both my parents are nurses. And beyond that, I also grew up a preacher's kid. And so very engaged in church. And so from the standpoint of their chosen careers and those being careers in which they served other people. There was also the, religious and spiritual component in teaching to serve others. And so that also, shaped a lot of my passion and drive as to who I am as an individual. And so as a young adult, I got involved in, some community organizations and serving my community on, a couple of different boards and authorities and then was asked in, my early 30s to consider running for office. So it's just, sort of always from a very early age been, part of the my own consciousness and narrative that would be important to be involved and serve my community in some way.
And after you graduated, can you just walk us through your career as to where did it all begin in terms of you had mentioned that you were also an educator, and then got into like the software side of it, and then you were a county commissioner, and now you're in government relations. Can you just walk me through the connecting dots and walk us through that? So I'm really curious to hear that.
Sure. Well, and there's some overlaps in some of those things, right? My time serving as a county commissioner, and actually, it's sort of right in the middle of that was when I went through a career change. After I graduated with my undergrad, I went to corporate America, and was working in marketing and business development. And after a few years, I wound up having lunch with a former professor at my university, and they were actually looking for someone. The university was building a new fine arts complex, a new amphitheater. They were looking for someone to help with marketing, and one thing led to another, and I took on a contract with the college to help in that area, and then eventually went full time, and that was in mid 2008, and thus began my career in higher education, which evolved. I originally was not in a capacity to work in the classroom with students. But while I was there, I almost immediately I began working on my master's degree, and I focused on organizational leadership. And there was an administration change at the college, and I was tapped to begin to work in student affairs. And so, student development, leadership programming, co-curricular programming. And this is the area where I ultimately landed. And when we developed some student leadership courses and programs, along with others at the university, we created a co-curricular program that was part of the requirements to graduate. And that's what put me in the classroom working with students. And it was very passionate about that work. I still hear from former students, and in fact, just talked to one yesterday. But my focus was very much on helping them to prepare, right, for life after college. Career readiness, leadership, training and qualities, and internships. How are you prepared for a job on day one? And so a lot of great experience there, an opportunity to help shape some lives, and then I was presented with an opportunity in 2015 to go back to corporate America, and this time in the fintech space, specifically with a software company, and so it was the right time for me. It was the right time for my family, and an opportunity that I felt like I really needed to take advantage of. And so then for the next several years, I worked with community banks all across the country, in our software was very focused on portfolio risk, and understanding portfolio risk for community banks. And this was on the heels of some new accounting standards that were coming down for banks regarding their loan loss reserves. So how do we guard against, right, what happened in the Great Recession when banks failed? Well, that's largely mandated by the Federal Accounting Standards Board. And so there was a new methodology that was enacted. It was called the Current Expected Credit Losses. Our software focused on helping banks with that. And then over time, we merged with a company out of Austin, Texas. The organization that I was a part of began to grow. Then I took on some responsibilities with helping to integrate the companies, and my day-to-day was very focused in sales. Initially as an individual contributor, and then in building out teams, and so we always positioned ourselves as more of a, I mean, yes, it was sales, but it's very technical, and understanding exactly what the software is doing, what problem it's solving. And so that gave me a really I think, important education into the world of community banking, the role that banks play in keeping Main Street America running and helping small businesses to build and grow and expand and build jobs, you know, as well as larger businesses as well. So that gave me, on the professional side, some professional diversity, but when you look forward to what I'm doing now, great experience as I engage with legislators on a lot of these very prescient economic, healthcare, and democracy and elections issues. Kind of in between there, I you know, was very fortunate that both the university that I worked for and then later the fintech firm appreciated my, you know, passion for public service. And so in 2012, that's when I ran for county commission and was ultimately elected to serve two terms. And so both, again, the university and the fintech firm supported that work, and I was able to do that concurrently, which gave me a whole other host of experiences and knowledge about, you know, public service and how decisions on that level affect people on a very day-to-day basis. You know, that's local government is the government closest to the people, and the decisions that are made there, you know, have immediate and lasting impact on those communities. So it was a very rewarding experience. I also got involved right away with what in Georgia is called ACCG, but it's the State's Association for Counties. And so I wound up serving on the board of managers for that organization and built a great network across the state with other elected officials. And, you know, that gave me an opportunity not to see not just what was affecting my community, my county, but counties all across the state of Georgia, other rural counties, urban, metro. And so, again, a very rewarding experience.
And at what point did you decide that you want to get into the field of advocacy and lobbying? And for me, I mean, until this point, you know, before I met you, I thought both of them stood for the same thing. So if you, for the sake of the audience, could you just explain the difference as well between advocacy and lobbying?
Well, you know, and you're right, Deepak, from the sense that, you know, regardless of what you call it, lobbying or advocacy, you are endeavoring to enact affect policy, you know, and you'll be working with policymakers and legislators and working to affect, you know, certain policies. When I was serving on the ACCG Board of Managers, you know, the association served really as our organization, our arm to lobby or advocate for areas of interest or impact to local counties. In particular, you know, looking to defend against policies that would take away from what we call local control, more in favor of state control, you know, or in, you know, looking to advocate for local, what we call local legislation. So if a new city was to be chartered. And so ACCG was an area where I first, you know, probably on a grander scale, got some experience, though I did intern with a lobbying firm in my early college days, by the way. So I had quite an education there. But in actually being in front of legislators and having those conversations, I did a lot of that when I was serving on the board of managers for ACCG. And so, you know, when you look at the time frame, I took office in January of 2013. And ended, you know, my term as an elected official in December of 2020. So a lot's happened in the country in those years. Mm-hmm. And for me personally, I saw the growth of something that concerns me greatly for not just our state, but our country. And that is this ever increasing hyper partisanship, where I don't know that I would say that it represents the interest of the majority of the people in this country, but those who are getting time on the microphone, so to speak, or the what's being uplifted by the media are the more extreme sides to arguments and along the party continuums. And what we've seen grow is as this hyper-partisan rhetoric gets more attention and more steam, the ability to sit down and have robust and productive debate seems to have decreased. That we at all levels seem to be positioning ourselves where, oh, you're a member of the opposite party. We can't have a conversation. Oh, you're sponsoring that legislation, and there's a D behind your name or an R behind your name. Well, so I can't support you in that. And that's problematic. That's unproductive for citizens and having actual thoughtful thoughtful conversations and discussions and moving good governance and sound policy forward. Part of the impetus in starting Georgia First for me was how do I continue to serve and advocate for good policy and things that will help and grow the middle class. How do I, use my experiences and my knowledge to bring something forward that would be good for my friends and neighbors and our state? And so that was really what drove me to begin Georgia First. You ask a little bit about what's the difference between lobbying versus advocacy. Lobbying firms, so to speak, might take a number of clients with varied interests or missions, and those interests for a client might be very singular. Maybe a lobbying firm has a client that's singularly focused on housing and housing policy. And they might have another client that's singularly focused on waste management. I mean, you name the issue or the industry that has is regulated or that has policy that's going to affect what they're doing. And so lobbying firms will have often a varied number of clients with varied interests or agendas. And so long as they don't conflict, that can make up the client base. Whereas when I talk about advocacy, Georgia First is an organization that has, three policy areas of interest. We're going to stay laser focused on those three areas, and we advocate the organization itself is we have a lobby team, to help with those conversations. But we are advocating for positions and policies that further the organizational mission. And so that's a little bit of a nuanced difference. And in terms of clients or services, we work with other organizations that align with the mission or parts of the mission. And that would be the difference between the two.
Okay. And if you had to talk a little bit about your three areas of focus, what would those be?
So economy, healthcare, democracy, and elections. Now that those are broad areas, and we realize that does allow us to, kind of wrap our arms around several things. And I like to use economy as an example. given my own experience in education, but also just firm belief about the future strength of economy, it really starts with education, ensuring that we are equipping the future workforce, and ensuring that it's a literate workforce, that they are prepared for the jobs of the future, not just the jobs of today, and that we are doing our best to reach all demographics, right? One way that you address sometimes pervasive poverty issues, or disparity in economic status is ensuring a firm foundation in education, so that these individuals can take advantage of opportunities. And when you look at their graduation rates and correlation between poor graduation rates and, for example, the number of individuals entering the criminal justice system, or the or perhaps juvenile justice, there's a strong correlation, right? If we're not doing an effective job in educating our children, there's a strong correlation in lower graduation rates and higher rates of individuals who are in the criminal justice system. So, that's an important area that, when I talk about economy, maybe immediately your thought doesn't go to education, but it's the foundation of it, in our mind. And so one of our early initiatives was focusing on the literacy rate in Georgia, which has been historically low for a number of years. And, there is a lot of momentum right now in the legislature focused on literacy in Georgia and early childcare, because we understand and we've known for years, right, that the formative years for brain development are between birth and 5 years of age. And so starting those foundations in reading and literacy earlier, making sure that we have adequate funding for our early childcare programs. So, that's again, at a high level, our three policy areas. Under healthcare, we're looking at access. We have a rural healthcare crisis in Georgia. So, looking at access, especially in rural communities where we are, as a state, have been focused on locating new economic development, bringing in new industry. But oftentimes, these new industries are going into areas that maybe don't have adequate housing or maybe don't have adequate health care, and that can pose a real problem. Also, when you're in a rural community that doesn't have adequate health care or access to health care, maybe you don't get one of these new economic development opportunities. And so in thinking about the long-term strength and viability of Georgia's economy, those are the type of things that we're focused on. And then under democracy and elections, it's a couple of things: ensuring engagement, helping to advocate for policy that ensures that elections are secure, they're safe, they're accessible, and that they're fair, and that the public understands and believes that they're fair. We're in a state right now, in many places, not just in Georgia, where voter confidence needs to be restored.
Thanks so much for explaining that to us, Natalie. Any final thoughts of wisdom or any types of tips or suggestions you would like to give in terms of what are the do's and don'ts of lobbying before we end this conversation?
Do's and don'ts, be strategic, know your audience, genuinely be interested in getting to know people and why they believe what they believe, why they have the positions that they have, and be willing to have those discussions. You can't come to a place of agreement if you've been at a place of disagreement, if you won't genuinely engage in conversation. And then, live to fight another day. Just keep going.
Awesome. Very good words of advice to end this wonderful conversation. Natalie, I wish you all the best in your endeavors. I'm pretty sure it'll shine. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Deepak.